week off of the Hanukkah Torah, which we finished last week. Just remember the two trees leading into with all those tubes and branches into a very well endowed menorah with all kinds of, according to some, 49 branches, according to others, 343 branches. So that's an awful lot of potential for oil, and a never-ending supply of oil being fed into these branches by the two trees. Right? Okay. And now we're up to the next prophecy, which begins with Perkei. Okay, it's going to start to get bizarre if you haven't felt it's been that way yet. Okay? I went back to my state of the reverie, and I lifted up my eyes and I saw the name Megillah Afa. Okay, Targum writes, the whole Megillah Pircha. He saw a Megillah, a scroll, whether it has Echichayim or not, but a scroll. It's rolled up, and then you open it up like Megillah says. Pircha means flying. Okay. Okay, that's the most Mepharshim say. Okay, Rashi cites the Gemara in Maseches Erevin that says that it means kefula. It means Megillah kefula. It was rolled in a double rolling, like the way we roll the Megillah. Okay, whatever it is, it's something that is that everybody can see from far. Okay, Rashi says this is the same Megillah that begins with Yechezkel's Nevuos, chapter 3 of Yechezkel, reading Zechariah, Perikot. One of Yechezkel's first Nevuos is about that prophet reading from a Megillah about the punishments that are impending upon Israel. And then, after describing this Megillah, he's told to eat it. Remember that one? Yechezkel's first Nevuah, yeah. So Rashi says that it's the same Megillah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see what about this Megillah.
Why
would
it be the same Megillah?
Rashi sees two contemporaries, although Yechezkel was quite a bit before Zechariah. Let's see what this not this prophecy. Okay. So the angel called him. Okay, here it's Vayomer Eli, it doesn't say whom, but it's that angel that we saw in the last chapter. Ma Taroeh, what do you see now? Vamara Niroeh Megillah Afa. I see a flying Megillah. And I'm able to tell how big it is. Now how can you tell that? Is he estimating? Is he guessing? He says, Orka Esrim Ba'ama, Barachba Eser Ba'ama. 20 amos by 10 amos. Okay, that would be about 30 feet by 15 feet. An amos is about a foot and a half. Okay, 30 feet by 15 feet. That's about... This part of the wall, let's see what I mean. Okay. Now, if you would open up a concordance and look for these dimensions, you will find it for one thing in the Bible. There's something in the Bible that's 20 amos by 10 amos. Anyone have it? Okay. What leads into the Beis Hamikdash? The Ulam, what's known as the Ulam, leading into the Beis Hamikdash, is exactly that dimension. Therefore, he's speaking of a sort of an introduction that leads into the Binyan Beis Hamikdash. This is what I see in this Megillah. Now, we have been speaking until now about prophecies to prepare these people for the Second Commonwealth, the Beis Hamikdash is about to be built. Let's see what you can do with it. There are great, great potentials in the world right now with the Greeks and new people that appreciate beauty and wisdom. And if you can convince them that the Jewish approach to these things is the true approach, then you will in essence, control the minds of and the power of the world. Okay? So that is what we've been learning until now. Now the prophet says, the Beis Hamikdash is about to be initiated, and this is what this Megillah Afra represents. This is the just made is that the if a Jew feels that the only way for me to get by in business is to steal in my weight, then that's a pisaron in emunah. Not just that you know, God told me not to do this, so I'm violating God. Any other error is like that. God says not to eat treif, so if I eat treif, it's a pisaron in emunah, of course, right? You might not do it in front of a person, right? You know, I keep running into someone in the neighborhood who I know used to be from guy. He used to be a yarmulke anymore. And anytime he sees me, I see him. Like I make believe I don't see him. He runs across the street. He doesn't want to see me. If I see him on Shabbos, he's not wearing a yarmulke. He's very like, I said, okay, that's at least good. It's a madrega. He doesn't want to be, you know, he doesn't want to be seen with a yarmulke on. So he feels so like ashamed or something. But everything we do, if we disobey God, is a chisaron in emunah. There's no question about it. But when it comes to business, it's not just that you're disobeying Hashem. You're causing a loss to another person. There's a huge chisaron in emunah here that you feel that you can't make it the way Hashem says you should. This is the way Hashem wants us to run our business, but I won't succeed that way. It's a chisaron in emunah. All right, anyway. So here he says the way to succeed in this second commonwealth is if the Eifa is true and the Eifa is real. Look at Rashi and Pasuk Vav. Rashi says, "V'omar mahi miyotei shetomar elai lerot." What is this thing going out that you're telling me to look at? What's going out? V'mezos ha'Eifa shetirei yotei k'min Eifa shemod v'inva. You see a measure. Something that everyone recognizes a measure. What you might think is a scale or something. Rashi says, "La'achar shvi'siha amar zoti midot shemaku bo osam sheinehem b'chol aretz zigzol v'lashok latin eifal adil shekel nizdaz mahem sal b'sal." Wow. Rashi refers to all sorts of violations in the marketplace that the Jews are engaging in that's keeping the Shekhinah from being in this building for good. Right. Rashi lists a number of examples that making the who's making the weights smaller and who's making them bigger. No, the grocer is making it smaller. He wants to sell you. He wants you to take less bananas than what you're paying for. And the consumer is making it bigger. Right. What? Right. So. And even the last thing Rashi mentions, the average person would think there's nothing at all wrong with this. In fact, the average person would think this is the way it's supposed to be. For instance, I borrow 2 pounds of coffee from you this week. And I say, I'll give you back coffee in 2 weeks. And in between, coffee becomes twice as expensive. So what am I supposed to do? Well, I borrowed, no? That's called sa'a b'sa'a, and it would be considered interest. Sa'a b'sa'a means you pay back what you took. You take it what the value is. That's what you took.
Instead of giving the same value,
Well, when you deal with futures in that way, and there's a difference in what you're dealing with Jews and non-Jews. If it's a business transaction, what you do is you do something called the heter iska, which means a business heter. Or it's not called a loan, it's called an investment, it's not called an interest, it's called dividends or
something else on no longer is. Oh, so you're getting around it pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, the Torah doesn't want you to charge interest to a poor person who needs the money, can't be eaten up by extra payments. So when I want to make money, you know, by borrowing $10,000 from you, why shouldn't you get a piece of that? Okay, so that's what Rashi says, these practices. Now, I think it's significant that Rashi mentions this, because to the average person, Greek or anyone, go and ask any person in the street how much coffee I'm supposed to give back in 2 weeks. Right? everyone's going to think, David, you borrowed 2 pounds, you pay back 2 pounds. Right? Why should I lose? Because you borrowed something from me. Right, anyway, so Rashi's saying that we have to follow the Torah's just laws governing the marketplace.
Undoubtedly, very big news
stands. Yeah.
So land was impoverished, and as you said, people
mm-hmm.
are not successful people.
Right? Remember the way Chagai referred to it? Remember Chagai was putting money into a pocket with holes in it?
So there's two ways to get down to them. Whatever, I can price 5 quarts of coffee.
Okay. Now the property gets harder. Let's read Toshib Zion. Glenn, would you read Zion, please?
The lake is covered with space, the goats shut up after service to the
sun. Oh my goodness. Yeah, he sees a ferris, he says. Ferris is a type of metal. Right? It's also a lead. Okay. So there's something made of lead being lifted up, and there's a woman, one woman sitting on the in the middle of the Eifa. Who is this woman? This is the Yosef. Mm-hmm. This woman is dead. Take a look at the next pasuk. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm sorry that it's giving this a femininity, but according to Rashi, the woman inside the Eifa represents the Risha, the wickedness that is making the people feel in these unjust ways. And we have to cast away the desire for this. Everyone knows that the two great desires attacking each and every one of us, not necessarily lobster or eating on kosher, or there's a big desire, especially for Baal Tshuva, but arayos and mammon, right? So allow me, if I may, to refer to, these are not contemporaries of the Chayyim at all, they're earlier prophets, Yeshayahu and Amos, who spoke of just a miserable situation that guaranteed for Israel that the leadership and the social decay would be something that couldn't get the Jews out of their social morass. And it was as follows. This is chapter 8 of Amos and chapter 3 of Yeshayahu. That the women of the day, sorry Sheila, I have to say this, that's what's written there. The women of the day were so spoiled and forced their husbands and their officers and the kings and the men, all the men, into oppressing the poor because they wanted more wine, more jewelry, more. Yeshayahu mentions 24 things that these women were doing to their husbands to make that they required, and Yeshayahu says, and the men have to break the law to get them because they have to keep their wives happy. Right? Now, today's Eishes Chayil is obviously, but the men, the only way that they could keep these women happy is to break the law. It's to talk or deal with unjust ways. They don't want to get caught, of course. Okay, Amos is even harsher than you should.
Is that a metaphor?
His name.
Is that a metaphor?
I'm just wondering why Zechariah has a woman sitting there representing this. This evil. So if we go through with Ibn Ezra, if this is a similar prophecy continuing and it seems that way, then this represents these wicked people who will keep us from building the base of Mitzvah. God will smash them. And why that's a woman, I'm not quite sure.
Was it common in other cultures of that time to ascribe bad things to women?
You know, it's not. I think it's precisely because in Judaism the woman's place is much higher than in the other religions. You wouldn't consider in Islam a prophet complaining, why are you paying all this for the Jews? I mean, I think there's even a joke about this in Judaism, that the husbands are all doting on their wives. I mean, maybe I could be mistaken, but
I think that's a very good analogy.
So she's representing that whole framework. I was bringing it more specific, and as long as Sheila doesn't mind, then it's not hard to show me any reflection on women today. But
you look at drugs, for example, that's the biggest. At least the time blames drugs for the whole crime wave in after the 80s and the early 90s.
And to make that a feminine image is what you're doing, because that's the opposite desire in the eyes of the Chari. Yeah. Okay, but I took it to the more specific stage of what Yeshayahu was saying. In other words, you couldn't picture the nations where the women were so downtrodden, the women were so much not given a slave class, that a prophet wouldn't tell the men of such a people, why are your women requiring so much things, and why they're requiring so much of your resources.
Isn't this mythicizing of evil sort of un-Jewish? I mean, it's like it's separating responsibility from the individual into this force, which feels like very Christian. There's this goodness and support outside the person, whereas Nadim in general is saying, exactly what you said about Yishai Nemo, said these specific things he did, you violated these Torah precepts, you did because he wanted to keep your wives wrapped in jewelry because they're pushing you. You gotta give up those chatzam, you gotta do this. I mean, disembody you in this way. How does this help somebody that's Shubin?
This
feels
is,
like not Jewish.
This is Zakaria. What he did, how he went out to say over these nevuahs to the people, which we don't have here, by the way. All the first five chapters of Zechariah is about, first six chapters, is about these 13 visions of the night. And he doesn't even describe what he would do with those visions. Of course, he has to wake up in the morning after these 13 visions and now go deliver 13 different sermons.
But that's not the book. Material, and we don't get told really.
Not at all. In the very first week we started doing this, is that each parish member gives you six different categories of interpretation, right? Whatever you might say falls into one of these six categories.
Mm-hmm.
It's a contemporary message, or a raw message, a message for the distant future.
Mm-hmm.
So, philosophical, metaphysical message. So here it does take on this sort of mythological picture, because it's a dream after all. And dreams tend to be, no limits to it. Okay, let's see what he does with this. Okay, he says, this is the wickedness, and let's smash it. Vasoi 9. Then we will get the next step.
Vasoi 9, Bar Eira, Bine, Sitayan, Asim, Rote, Vruot, Bethan, Behem, Gredra, Hina,
okay, we're not really going to be able to understand what this prophecy is. Good. Let's see what that is. We'll have to decide, Glenn, whether you think it really ended up being positive, but this Nebuah is, I think, relatively easy to determine what it is once we decide who these two women are. Okay? Two women go out, they have wings, like the wings of a stork, which can carry a lot of stuff. Right? And they lift up this ephah and they're carrying it between heaven and earth. Right? Where are they taking this weight? Okay.
Let's see where they're taking it.
Can you see this?
Well.
What? Okay, well,
I'm not familiar too much with Zechariah, but it usually explained that Shemayim La'aretz. Haaretz of Shemayim seems to be a little bit of a reverse usual language.
Well, it took it up from the ground, so you know, just saying it starts from the ground, then it picks it up, and you can see it. It's hovering between the earth and heaven. But you're right. Usually Shemayim Ba'aretz, so you know.
And I said to the angel, El Hamalach Hadorah B, who spoke to Anna, Anna and him were with us at the Eifa. Where are they taking the Eifa?
Read one more.
Right on Ha'elai. Livnos La'bayis Bereshina, Uhuchan, and they're taken to the land of Shina, Ba'af to the house in the land of Shina. Sorry?
Babel.
And Uhuchan, and it will be established, Uhunicha Sham al Mukunata. And it will be set down there on her base.
Okay, so. Once this is actually a Maimar Chazal, that the two women represent the two kingdoms of Israel, Yehuda and Yamin on one side, and whoever returns to the center of us on the other side. And they will set up a place that will be established in Babel. This is never according to Barbanel, who I've sort of stayed clear from until now, says that it means that the seaboard in Babel will succeed more than the seaboard in Israel. Certainly produced more flourishing yeshiva and school and Talmud for that matter. Okay.
Why is this?
This is pretty clear. Because the Jews who went to Babel were less assimilated into the Greek and Roman sphere than the Jews who went to Israel, stayed in Israel. Almost like the last 50-60 years. I imagine that my family's situation is similar to many others. Both my mother's and father's side, there are members of the family who went to Israel in the 20s and 30s, and some who went after the war. Whoever went to Israel, no descendants are from today, not even about Tshuva yet, but whoever went to America, all the descendants are from. It's just, you know, the ones who went to, even though whether they went before the war, they went after the war. So he's saying here that the Jews who go to Babel will be more successful and more prosperous.
Is that from the short term? Is that from the spot? The period of the second bias? Or only the
remember who that quote thing was? He's not limited to anything. If you recall, earlier he says it could be at the time of the Greek, it could be any time in the distant future. So, when was this true? From very few Jews returned from Babel. Sefer Ezra says only 42,000 people in the 50 Jews returned from Babel. Well, remember, more than 1,000 years earlier, there were more than that amount from each tribe, right?
The pre-war rabbinic leadership that was against Zionism, did they ever bring this leadership up in terms of arguing against Jews going back to Israel?
Those people didn't learn Zechariah, but they brought other writings, sure.
They were against Aliyah, they were just against the land of Israel.
They were against Aliyah also. They were against, I'll say this. The historic character live in Israel too. They were against the political movement in Israel. We should not be politically involved in Israel without the coming of Mashiach.
But additionally, the European rabbis did not were neutral on whether any Jews should move to Israel and Palestine.
They wholeheartedly supported Jews moving to Israel and keeping mitzvahs that are tzvios in Israel.
See, America was a wasteland back then. So they had Israel, which had established Jewry, and America was saying that.
What they were against was that Jews should be politically involved, to try to climb the wall, as the Gemara says. Have from Zionist plenum and Zionist gatherings, things like that. Zionist is someone who wants to go to Israel and the mitzvahs. As he lost to your name, as Yirmiyahu said. Said. So the mitzvah name is mitzvahs. Now, a religious Zionist feels, as Rav Kook, Rav Yitzchak Kook, said, it's good to go to Israel. And Taka tried to bring about a political movement that can be considered like a racist tzmichat gilus thing. Okay. Right, so the upshot of this nevuah is that here's the prophet predicting a not so much of a success in Israel. It's as if though he's telling them, he's calling you to return. I'm calling you to be a Kiddush Hashem. I'm calling you to avoid these pitfalls that will lead to a destruction of all the stones in the wood of the Beis HaMikdash. At the same time, I'm telling you that there will be a fortified and established community in Babel throughout this time. Okay.
So how do we see the lineup of the women, the Ephah, the Ephah? I mean, how do we see the lineup of the consecutive sentences there?
The only way that this new commonwealth will succeed is if you can break this dependency on satisfying this woman. Now, whether you like to read it as, you know, an Amos or a Yeshayahu kind of direction, but you want to read it, you know, fully as the metaphor of your desire for these things, however you read it, this will not simply not succeed if you are intent on satisfying the
woman
inside
the program.
Right. Okay.
She wants what present she has?
She just wants to be satisfied and get what she wants. Fulfill her desire.
Well,
it doesn't matter so much where it is. Probably cook like things are better than.
Does anybody interpret the building in China as something evil, like something standing up to the Beis HaMikdash, like an alternative, like something else?
It would be hard to fathom that Hashem, that a Navi would refer to it. He seems to be saying that this is at least a positive development for you.
Or is it what
unless he's being sarcastic. Just, you know, Al Makuna Tab, Makuna Hashem. It's very interesting that you should connect this to Migdal Babel, because Migdal Babel is really not referred to anywhere in Tanakh.
That's
why we call it Migdal Babel. Shina is Babel.
Right.
Prophets often into the
mix.
Do you find Shinar
in that many other places
in Israel? Shinar is, you know, it's the Admat B'nei Chom, is it right? Shinar is, a poet's way of referring to Babel very often in Tanakh. But that's okay. But it's interesting. If you want to say this is a reference to me, so Babel, it's a big fetish. If you can prove it, you should write an article about it.
I want to have a good point with them. In terms of America and Earth is Raw.
Yeah.
Oh, I said, well, you know, it's all there is. There are a lot of people's families who came here that a lot of the people became married to non-Jews.
Yeah, they viewed their
majority of those people. You know, I don't know, you could compare it to
I'm not saying that America was a bastion of Torah values and, you know, the I'm just
what he's saying, the fire, because the people, they don't want to come back, so you have to give some encouragement, maybe. So maybe on you saying the prophecy, I don't know, he's screaming it, so I don't know. We're interpreting it, saying that this is what he's saying.
This is what we imagine he would have said in the streets, interpreting his own dream. I mean, this is why reading this book is so difficult. I told you
it would seem a little anti against the way he talks, because he would say, you know, you want a second commonwealth, then he's saying to these people, stay where you are. Don't come back. You know,
he is telling them, Lamaisa. I'm telling you, I just know the way it is. There's going to be an established community in Bethel.
But that doesn't say it exactly like that.
Of course, because the Bravanel is reading it from hindsight in Jewish history. We know that the Jewish community in Bethel, you know, out established the Jewish community in Israel.
But it seemed like the community in Bethel looked down upon the community in
in Israel, this is true. In the Talmud, that is the case. And an opposite is also true. The community in Israel, the Talmud, the community in Bava, they all have a little highfalutin for this. Right? But there's no question that the community in Bava produced much greater yeshivas. I mean, look, the Tanoim at Yavne v'Chachameha. The Christendom wiped out the Jewish community in Israel, while the exilarch, the Reish Gilusa, was established in Babel throughout the Golan period.
When did they die out?
I mean, Islam, we already said the end of the Golan period. Well, there's no good number on that, but the community in Israel definitely died out long before the community in Babel. When I say died out, I mean, very long established. But that's what this prophecy is. Now, in hindsight, you can look at it and say, that's what I can say. That's what I can say it talks about. Babel was still a flourishing yeshiva Torah world long after Israel, not because of the Romans, because of the Christians. Okay, let's take a look at the last Nevuah ever. This is the last one. There's two mountains of brass, Rashi says, a sign of the great strength of these two kingdoms. It doesn't say necessarily these two kingdoms, but whatever kingdoms are coming out. And he sees four chariots leaving from the mountains. Now, the number four is a very apocalyptic number, right? Not just connected to Pesach, but the four nations especially, right? Rashi refers to them as Babel, Babylonia, Modai, Persians, Medes, Yavon, Greece, and Edom, Rome. Okay, these are the four. The Merkava, Harishona, Susim, Shchorim, black horses. The Merkava Sheni is Susim Shchorim. First one is Susim Adonim, red, then black. Merkava Shlishi is Susim Levanim, then white. Merkava Rabi is Susim Brudim Amutsim. Some say that means spotted.
That means spotted trained horses.
Okay, now what do these represent? Let's go in order. The red horses of Bava, they bled you. Caused you to bleed by building the Beit HaMikdash, by destroying the Beit HaMikdash, carrying many of you off into slavery. Okay. Now, Rashi, I'm not doing Rashi's scheme. I'm not sure Rashi beat the Yavan. Rashi, Radak, and Sadia say that Modai are the black horses and Paras are the white horses. The reason why he says that Modai are black horses is because Larkibis Modai she shiris pneim shall Yisrael bine haman. Claims that the second group of horses is the Purim story. The third group of horses is the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. This, of course, is consistent with Rashi's opinion in Megillas Esther, that the story of Esther and Haman and Mordechai and Achashverosh is before, a good 20 years before the Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt. This, I submit to you, is not corroborated by all historians. Because many contemporary historians say that the Purim story was 20 to 30 years after the Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt. Or at least after it's after the Chada in
Zechariah.
There you go. Okay. But Rashi says that the black horses represent the Persians threatening us in the Purim story. The white horses represent the good Persian kings, Darius, Cyrus, Artaxerxes. That's the white horses. But Riyatsusim Brudim Amutsim. The last one, Rashi says, is Islam and Christianity. And they're spotted and speckled. They're all tools of God's wrath.
The black ones, those last ones are both Islam and Christianity.
This is Rashi says, "Lahakid Edom b'Yishmael." And Rashi says, "V'lo yadati ma lashon amutzim." I'm not sure what amutzim means. What does it say in your English? What are amutzim? Amutzim, amutzim.
Spotted,
common gray. Yeah. Gray? Yes, color. Okay. Amut
settlement
of smooth
or something like that?
Mutsin.
Mutsin
can be like a combination of black and white. Okay, so.
What sort of makes sense of the source? A spotty record sometimes better, sometimes worse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, they're coming from four directions. Okay, Ma'an Vamar Ma'amach, Adverbi Ma'ila Adoni, what are these four things? The Yana Malach, the Emre Lai, Eila Arba Ruchos Hashemayim Yotzos Nityateva Ladon Kol Aretz. These are the nations coming out from the four directions of the earth to contend with God. Here are the four directions. Edom comes from the east because the sun rises and it reddens the horizon. The black is Tzafon, is north, because it's dark in the north. Lavon, white, is Ma'arav, because the border of Israel is like white sand. And Darom is spotted like the stones of the desert in the Negev. This is why these four colors are connected to the four directions in this pasuk. What it means is that Israel will be attacked from all sides, even from the sea. Okay, my jet lag is still not over. Yeah. Okay, so I think maybe we will stop with this. Shabbat. Let me just do one more part. Shabbat asusim ashorim yotzim al eretz tzafon v'alvanim yotzu el achareihem. והברודים יסו אל ארץ התימן והמוצים יסו ויבקשו ללכת להתהלך בארץ ויאמר לכו התהלכו בארץ ותהלכתם בארץ. The Zuchari himself connects the four directions with the four colors I just mentioned. Okay, he connects to himself, and then he says the one that travels the longest are these Amutim. That makes sense. The fourth is always the one that's lasting longest, right? They're the ones that are still around, Ishmael and Edom. See? They're the ones that just keep going and keep walking in the earth and keep going on. Okay? Okay, let's just have just a few more sitting here. Yazeko see. But Yadaberi Lale more. And then he woke me up. And he yelled at me, the angel, Re'eha yotzim el eretz tzafon, and yizol etzruchi eretz tzafon. Look at the ones going up north. They have consoled me, or they have caused me to be at least a little calmed. Okay, his vision ends. Okay. Mm-hmm. What is the eretz tzafon? Eretz tzafon is Babel. Okay. They're going out to Babel. God has suppressed my anger in the north by destroying Babel.
Very bad.
The country of Babel. In other words, the Babel will still exist. The Jews are going to be living there for a long time and writing a Talmud there. But the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar and company, those guys are not long for their kingdom. What happens here is that each nation destroys the nation before them, and then that next nation causes God to have causes great suffering. Okay. See, Russia joins America to defeat Germany, right? And right after World War II, Russia becomes a Russia nation also. Right? So too, each nation that does God's bidding by destroying the previous nation, which was very evil, then the new nation becomes evil as well. Okay? So that's how this prophecy ends. I'm going to wrap it all up at the beginning of the next class, because of test. And I just want to know if it's okay if we dive in Marib now. Is that right? You dive in Marib?
Okay. Does anybody here need to die? I haven't died. No. Okay, Donovan? Okay, Donovan?